Good morning, everyone. This is John Fudu with the Geopolitics This Week podcast, and I am making my return as I sort of cheated last week by using the recording from my conversation with Jeremiah. Jeremiah is a very good friend of mine from The Exchange, the platform where I originally started writing, and I decided that our conversation was good enough that we could put it on my podcast as well as the platform that we write on, and so I cheated. I apologize for doing that, and I hope not to do that in the foreseeable future. I might do it every once in a while, because as much as these podcasts might sound like they're coming natural to me, they're pretty thoroughly outlined. I want to make sure that I stay on topic and my information is relatively up to date. And so to you, the audience, it sounds good. As some of these podcasts, like the first like big three podcasts I did, which were the South American and Brexit podcasts, the second episode, which was like detailing the state of conditions on the ground in South America, that was probably the most heavily scripted of all three, as that required me to sort of refresh myself on the area, make sure everything is up to date, I had all my dates right, because the last thing you want to do when you're citing historical or recent political events is use the wrong date. You look dumb if you do that. And so my goal is to have as few mistakes as possible, or at least get the dates close enough to where I don't sound that amateurish or stupid. So, but many of you are probably new listeners, and I want to shout out Raoul Powell of Real Vision and Global Macro Investor. He is a awesome dude. He's a great mentor. He noticed me on The Exchange while I was writing my geopolitical articles almost every day. And he, to start off the new year, took me under his wing, taught me how to write geopolitical articles based on a investment thesis rather than my sort of traditional three pillars of geography, finance, and the current political climate. And that was an absolute pleasure and an even greater honor for me to be asked to write a guest article for Global Macro Investor, a very selective investment publication read by all the major players in global finance. And that opportunity, again, after graduating in May of last year with the coronavirus and everything, employment chances looking pretty low, I had no expectation that 8 months later I'd be mentored by such a great man and he would be helping me try to find work. If you're not following Raoul Powell on Twitter, he is a very thoughtful, intelligent man, and probably one of the best mentors I've had. So to shout him out on Twitter, it's at Raoul, R-A-O-U-L-G-M-I, on Twitter. Amazing man and even better man to follow. And again, thank you for all of you who have joined as a result of Raoul. I have nothing but good things to say about him, and I hope this podcast isn't a letdown for you, as he set a pretty high bar for me, and so it's my goal to meet that bar. So, moving on from that, I'm going to outline what today's topic is. As I hinted on Twitter earlier today, the topic, well, I guess, because I'm recording Tuesday evening, and this will be up for you on Wednesday morning, so to change the phrasing there, what I hinted at yesterday, I think I got it this time. I'm going to be talking about now and for future podcasts, I'm going to be going country by country, which I think are the more consequential countries of the next several decades, and talking about what you should expect from the political, the economic, and age demographic environment from all these countries and why they're important. And hopefully, starting with America, this can be sort of the final segment of John's very deep exploration of American politics, as I think 5 or 6 of my most recent articles and most of my posts on Twitter are almost exclusively about American politics. And while I can't necessarily be blamed for that, because the past 2 months, especially the last 2 weeks, have been incredibly dense on the American domestic politics, but my goal is to sort of push that to as an option in the future and focus more on the bread and butter, which is why most of you are here, which is geopolitical perspective, what's going on across the world, and how those things affect the United States, or how those things just affect everyone in general. And so, the topic for today is America in the 2020s, getting a taste of the crunch. And as I sort of laid out earlier, I'm going to be touching on the political aspects, what Americans should expect from a political environment this decade. And we sort of gotten a taste of that already in 2020, and the economic conditions and the sort of age demographic conditions we should expect this decade. And then I'm going to conclude with some thoughts on the 2030s, and as a sort of a pick-me-up and a little of a bit of a lighter note to conclude on, as a lot of topics in geopolitics are pretty grim. But I think the conclusion of this will be relatively positive compared to sort of the other notes I've ended on. And so without further ado, we will begin with what Americans should expect, or just people who listen to this podcast, because I know I've got plenty of international listeners now, which is super awesome. Shout out to my Belgian, German, and French listeners, and my couple of listeners, I think, in New Zealand and Australia at this point. Shout out to all of you. But Americans are still my predominantly largest audience, so shout out to all the Americans in the audience as well. And so, without further ado, what people should expect from American politics in 2020. As I've sort of hinted at this week with my Monday article on the realignment of the Republican Party, both parties are undergoing a realignment. And what I mean by a realignment is that the parties are beginning to pivot on policy, but also source their support from different areas. So the Republican Party, to sort of summarize my article published on Monday, it's on my Substack, Republicans are moving from the triumvirate, to use the sort of Roman term, of corporate, libertarian, and evangelical voters to a coalition of workers, libertarian, small business types, and a religious fusion between evangelical Christians, you sort of traditional Protestants and Baptist voters, and traditional Catholics, which have sometimes voted with the Republican Party, but have largely been without a home politically. But there's going to be more of an emphasis on a more diverse religious coalition and Republican voting circles from now on, which will include traditional Catholics and some elements of the Sikh and Hindu community. The Democrats have essentially pushed off any possible realignment for the past two election cycles, 2016 and 2020. Hillary Clinton was broadly a successor of the Obama technocratic management, and a Biden is sort of a reincarnation of that, but seen as a more of a voice of calm and reason. The Democrats had their last major realignment with the election of Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was fairly unique as a political candidate, because compared to Mondale, Ronald Reagan's last major election competitor in the 1984 election cycle, Bill Clinton was from the heart of America as the governor of Arkansas, broadly had vast appeal to workers while also having a lot of appeal to the Republican, the new Democratic base, which is sort of the corporate Wall Street types. And this would sort of, in his second term, as his first term was broadly imprinted with a lot of inexperience as compared to other presidential cabinets. He brought in a lot of people from Arkansas, people who weren't DC types, who didn't know how the federal bureaucracy functioned. And so there were a lot of policy and presidential hiccups in the first 2 years of his first term, which were eventually smoothed out in the last year of his first term and then the rest of his second year term. And so in the second year term, his second 4 year term, rather, was broadly characterized by what you could consider technocratic managerial management. A lot of expert, wonkish professor types managing the federal bureaucracy, who with federal experience will get to know the bureaucracy, know how it functions, and best to learn the best ways to manipulate it and use it to meet political goals or just to manage the state. The Democratic Party was characterized by this. And so the reason why the 2000 election between Bush and Gore was so close was because the Republican Party was still using the base that got Ronald Reagan elected and then Bush elected for his single term. corporations, small business libertarians, and evangelicals. The problem is, Al Gore, who, to be polite, is a more managerial technocrat than Clinton was, had pretty broad appeal with American corporate types. And as a result, not only did Bush barely win out, I think in the 2000 election, Republicans ended up taking back the House and were barely able to take back the Senate, but don't quote me on that. I know they retook one of the houses. And then the election for Bush was eventually called based on Florida, as Republicans traditionally have a stronger base with retirees, and that's what probably clinched it for him with the extra 500 votes needed for him to win. But because of the Democrats sort of sharing this corporate managerial base with the Republicans, presidential races got a lot closer. It's why the Clinton election with Trump was so close, less than 75,000 votes, and it's why the 2020 election was so close, less than 50,000 votes in all the major swing states, and why the 2000 and 2004 elections were so close, Bush v. Kerry and Bush v. Gore. It would have been better, and that is a poster box that just tipped over. Ignore that. The reason why it would have been much better for Democrats if Hillary had lost her nomination for the Democratic presidency along with Joe Biden, allowing Bernie Sanders to be the candidate. And that's not because Bernie Sanders would have been at all competitive in either election cycles. In 2020, he would have been more competitive, but in 2016, he would have gotten absolutely killed by Trump. And a lot of that has to do with the fear of socialism, but beyond that, it would have been good for the Democratic Party because such a spectacular loss, or just a loss in general, would have forced the Democrats to have a very honest conversation with themselves. What is our message going forward? What bases do we need to appeal to? Where are we losing support? Where are we gaining support? Where do we need to sort of cordon ourselves off and reform the party? The Democrats didn't do that. The election of Trump in 2016 essentially delayed the Democratic realignment, as Democrats essentially shut down all internal debate about the future of the party in order to be exclusively anti-Trump. Not that they had any better prescriptions or ideas or policy ideas, just because they're against Trump. And it wasn't a bad strategy. In 2018, a lot of their House victories could be almost exclusively laid on the growing, I don't think this appeals to word, but they're growing unappeal. The unappealing nature of the Trump administration became a very good campaign strategy for the Democrats. So they won the House in 2018 and narrowed the Republican lead in the Senate. And in 2020, pretty effective campaign strategy for a presidential election, as Biden, lacking pretty substantial policy platform, exclusively ran on the platform of, "I'm not Trump, I'm a known variable. You've known me, I was vice president for 8 years, and my job is to heal the soul of the nation." Whether or not he's going to do that, doesn't matter. That's how he got elected. The problem is that when you have such a deviation from a party that no longer runs on policy prescriptions like Obama did in 2008, to one that's almost exclusively anti-Trump, Clinton's run in 2016 and Biden's run in 2020, your party, despite showing some success, tends to rot from the inside. And so, as I hinted at in the article on Monday, the Democratic Party is exhibiting a lot of behaviors that you could attribute to the Whigs. The Whigs are a 19th century party that existed between 1812 and 1860, roughly. And this party was almost exclusively created by a coalition of three different groups. Those who were corporate, sort of unionist-leaning workers, people who hated Andrew Jackson. So you got your first problem there. And then the third group, people who were lukewarm to anti-slavery. The worker segment and the emancipation segment would go on to form the Republican Party, when the Whig Party eventually collapsed. But what is very similar to the 2020 election of Joe Biden to the 1848 election, the last major election the Whigs won, is that President Zachary Taylor was a former U.S. general, so not even from the Whig Party. He wasn't even a registered Whig until 1846 or 1847. But he was most widely known for his feats during the Mexican-American War, which often saw him undersupplied, undermanned, and undertrained against a more superior Mexican force. But despite the odds, he always triumphed, made him a virtual American hero overnight, and a known political force. And as a result, the Whig Party, which had seen its declines in the House and the Senate for the past four election cycles, were able to basically clinch it, win the presidency, take back the House, and narrow the Democratic majority in the Senate to 33 seats to 23 seats Whig. This was obviously a much smaller country at the time, so the Senate was a lot smaller as well. But the problem with this election, despite winning, and winning's almost universally a good thing, is that the Whigs didn't run on issues. They just ran on Zachary Taylor's reputation as being a hero general. And so when you have something like that, when Zachary Taylor kind of runs as this hero of the country and a calming presence on the nation, which was starting to experience the second nullification crisis, as the first one was under Andrew Jackson originally, as South Carolina threatened to secede, and Andrew Jackson sent a letter to the governor of South Carolina saying, if you secede, I'll be sending the army to retake your state. Andrew Jackson effectively, despite all his flaws, and there are a lot, delayed the inevitable Civil War for basically 30, 40 years. Zachary Taylor, as a Whig, was elected to be not only a unifying moment for the country during this time, but as another 4 years of pause on the issue of slavery. Zachary Taylor would end up dying within the first year of his term from a stomach ailment, as he ate a ton of bad fruit and gave him a stomach bug, which ended up killing him. And as a result, his vice president was broadly unpopular with the Whig Party, which caused basically the entire Whig Party to sort of consume itself. But beyond that sort of extra details I provided for presidential history, the Democrats, ironically, are sort of repeating history. The Democrats ran Joe Biden, who is a broadly popular man. I consider myself now a political independent. I deregistered from the Republican Party of March of last year, mostly because Trump's management of the coronavirus epidemic was horrendous and I didn't want to be involved anymore. I decided that in order to be a pretty formidable force in the sort of commentary space, I need to be politically neutral. And so leaving the party, deregistering from the Republican Party, and sort of allowing myself to step back and become desensitized to all these sort of issues, I could broadly say Joe Biden is a pretty popular man. His pre-election polling and favorability was always north of 50%, something Trump has always struggled to do, as he always pulls between 40 and 50%. Joe Biden is a known quantity, and like Zachary Taylor, is ran on a platform of being a calming presence on a country that is going through turmoil. And again, you're confronted with the same problems. A party that does not run on a policy platform that is broadly supported and broadly understood tends to lead to a party rotting from within. Like the Whigs, Democrats would narrowly keep the House and gain seats in the Senate. Before the Georgia runoff, I think it would be more reflective of the 1848 performance of Zachary Taylor. But due to Republicans pouring their gasoline on their chances on the Georgia Senate election due to $2,000 checks, Joe Biden was able to clinch out a tie in the Senate to where, for basically appointments, he is able to pass with Kamala Harris as the tie-breaking vote, get anyone through that he wants, gets the cabinet he wants, which is exactly what Trump did in his first 2 years. The problem is that, like Zachary Taylor, when you're sort of in the middle or in the minority, you still need a two-thirds majority of the Senate in order to pass major budgets, major legislation. And Joe Biden has made it clear he's not going to blow up the filibuster. If you're not willing to blow up the filibuster and the moderate segment of your party doesn't want to do it either, you're not going to be passing major legislation without major support. So in a sense, 1848, 2020, almost identical. If Democrats stand a chance in the 2022 election cycle, Biden needs to have a successful first 100 days. That's not necessarily good for the health of the party, as the party needs a substantial loss in order to start having a serious conversation about what's next. And it looks like they're setting themselves up for that. This impeachment crisis that has sort of taken the House after the debacle that was January 6th of last week, Democrats have been sort of forced in this position of a harder than rock place. And I wrote about this in the article that went out today in the morning, talking about the ramifications of January 6th and 2 to 3 week projection. Democrats, because they were the targets of the riot, quote unquote, on January 6th, they're looking to shore up support with their base to make sure they don't look weak, and to show that there is a punishment for challenging Democrats in power. And so they're pushing through the impeachment, which is now in the House and likely to make its way to the Senate by probably Monday of next week. The problem with the impeachment is that because of Senate rules, if you pass an impeachment and the Senate takes it up, I don't think McConnell's likely to take it up until Trump leaves, in which it will be in Majority Leader Schumer's hands. But when you take on an impeachment, it dominates the schedule. That means there's no bills being passed through the Senate. That means there's no appointments making their way through the Senate. That means there's no treaties making their way through the Senate. Essentially, everything's put on pause. If the Senate Democrats take up the impeachment, which I think they're likely to do, I think strategically it is a bad decision for Biden's first 100 days. But if they're looking for an early political win to sort of shore up support within their base, I think they're probably going to do it. But when you do that, Biden will not have his cabinet appointments for likely 2 to 3 months, requiring him to rely on Trump holdovers. Those cabinet officials that were appointed and approved by the Senate for Trump are obviously going to go with Trump when he leaves on the 20th. But those who have been serving in that sort of middle ground role, the temporary, they're staying. And so people who have been running the Department of Defense will be there still, Trump appointees. And as a result, Biden's going to have to work with them for the first 2 to 3 months of his administration. There will be no stimulus talks with Republicans. Some Republicans will lock ranks and they will not touch a stimulus vote, at least not until an impeachment is concluded, which is 2 to 3 months out. Schumer will likely try to push it through within a month, but I find that unlikely. I think 2 months is more likely, with 3 months being sort of the other end of that scenario. Without a stimulus within the first month or two of his administration, their economy is likely to go into recession in the first quarter of this year, as the consequences of the Christmas lockdowns and re-lockdowns in some areas of the country start to take hold, as people who are furloughed are not brought back on and made unofficially unemployed, and we'll start seeing unemployment numbers start to go up. We've already seen unemployment numbers for December go up, 148,000 jobs lost, which were almost exclusively women, which for Democrats looks pretty bad, and there were 16,000 jobs gained by men. For a party that sort of runs on gender issues, that looks even worse. And so when you don't have your appointments, who are supposed to help you roll out the vaccine and roll out your agenda, and you don't have your stimulus to help buoy support for the Senate candidates that won in Georgia almost exclusively on the $2,000 check issue, you have the possibility of a re-energized Republican base showing up in force to primary Republicans who broke ranks to thrust Democrats from swing districts in those competitive House races and very competitive Senate races, which means at least maybe one or two of the legislative branches will return to Republican control in 2022, and setting up things for a pretty strong 2024 Republican performance, as if Biden's term as president gets turned basically into, it's still Biden's term, no doubt, but it's dominated by Trump's almost, what is the term? Trump's undying influence on politics, which of course looks bad on Democrats. And Biden will hate that. Biden is very much a guy who's wanted to be president, to have a legacy of his own. And if he hadn't run for president, he would have a legacy as a vice president, which is a very good one. But now that he's president, he's going to want the same thing for his presidential term. And if impeachment goes through, which I think it will, his entire term will be essentially Democrats punishing Republicans for Trump. And that will not look good. That is not healing the soul of the country. That's not unifying the country. Strategically, long-term, I think it's very bad. Very bad for the country. Very bad for everyone. But in the short term, it shores up support with Democrats among their base. And so, take that as you will. And as I said, if they do this, 2022 looks very good for Republicans, and so does 2024, as I think it's very likely that not only will a Republican candidate win both terms, 2024 and 2028, but I think it's very likely that a Republican holds their House and the Senate for at least his full first term, his or her first term. As I know, Nikki Haley is speculating about jumping into the race, so she may be the possible Republican candidate. But in general, what we should expect from politics is Democrats trying to pass an agenda, which they didn't really have. Trump's legacy sort of interfering in that agenda as his influence on politics outlives his presence in politics. And then how that sets up Republicans for a very red wave-like return in the subsequent elections. And so with that, let's move on to the economics of the Americans in the 2020s. This decade will have some of the toughest economic conditions the country has faced since the Great Depression. But it will be a different sort of depression, as what characterized the Great Depression is essentially the American industrial capacity outstripped America's ability to consume the goods produced by industry. So what ended up happening? You have credit appearing all over the place to help consumers who were very cash rich, but not cash rich enough to afford these expensive goods produced by industry to help do it. That's how you got the Roaring Twenties, and that's how it all came to a very quick end in the 1930s. The depression we're likely to face here is what's known as a capital crunch. The 2020s will be characterized by rising interest rates, increased capital costs, and taxes that are growing as baby boomers retire and take the vast wealth they've accumulated from their state pension funds, their 401ks, individual brokerage accounts. They start pulling that money out of the system. And the reason why that's significant is that the baby boomers were at one point the largest segment of the population. Millennials have outgrown them at this point, but they're also the wealthiest generation, not only in this country's history, but in world history. People who have had so much money that they created the subprime crisis bubble. They allowed Brazil to build a railroad up the escarpment, a vertical cliff face, defying gravity in a sense, and can be broadly characterized by something I think Ben Bernanke said in 2012, was that if you have enough money in the system, it is cheaper to flatten the mountain to save on fuel cost instead of building a road on it. That's the type of money that's been in the system for the past 40 to 50 years of world history, most of it coming from the United States. And as a result, the rest of the world is going to go through depression-like conditions. But the United States is going to go through a pretty steep and pretty tough recession. And as a result, all the things that we're used to, cheap loans for houses, cheap mortgages, non-existent interest rates in bank accounts, cheap student loans, they're going to disappear virtually overnight. And this will start in 2022. The good news, though, is that you should expect food and fuel costs to remain the same. American agricultural capacity has always outstripped its ability to consume. It's why food is so cheap in this country, why health-related ailments such as diabetes and obesity are such a huge crisis in this country. Not only is the food plentiful, but it's also cheap. And then second, your fuel costs are likely to remain low as well. The American shale boom has made America virtually independent, but also very cheap. Shale's break-even price is now probably between $20 and $30 a barrel, almost competitive with Saudi Arabia's, which their cost is $20 a barrel. And as a result, even if global oil markets, let's say there's a war in the Gulf preventing Saudi and Iranian, Iraqi, Kuwaiti oil from making it to world markets, we won't be affected. The United States has essentially become a closed energy market with prices that don't reflect the global one. And as a result, food and fuel costs remain low. And as interest rates rise within the entire system of the United States, the entire market, you will start getting interest again in your savings accounts. So that's a positive. But when it comes to all these broad negatives, it's not that great. It's like saying you lost your house, but you still have your car. You can sleep there. Okay. Not great. Better than nothing. But 2023, we will start in, for, let me get my timeline straight. So when the baby boomers start retiring en masse, the first baby boomer tapped into their Social Security benefits in 2018. A majority of baby boomers will be tapping into their state pension funds, Social Security, and Medicare by 2022. And so by 2023, the nation will start confronting the major crisis that is its social welfare system, Social Security and Medicare. Because when all the money gets pulled out of the system and all the baby boomers retire, they're not earning money anymore. There's no tax money coming in. 2016 and 2018 were the two best years in American history for tax collection. Tax collection that was north of $3.8 trillion. And yet, we still had deficits between $500 and $1 trillion every year. That's insane. But in 2022, 2023, 2024, 2025, and 2026, tax revenues are going to go off a cliff because roughly a third of the U.S. population is not going to be working anymore. And that generation has been some of the largest taxpayers and consumers and funders of investments around the world in the U.S. economy. And when that money gets pulled out of the system, your Social Security and Medicare are in huge trouble. And as a result, 2023 through 2026 will be the first time since Ronald Reagan in 1982 where the Congress is going to pass major Social Security and Medicare reform. And that's where we start getting into options. Here's what's not going to happen. MMT, Modern Monetary Theory. This suggestion that the government can have $10 trillion budgets with $8 trillion deficits, where the Federal Reserve monetizes all of the debt and no inflation will be experienced. One, that's insane. Two, it's not going to happen. Three, it requires a Fed chair to be appointed that will support it and a Congress that will approve it. Most of the Republican and Democratic Party is still moderate. MMT is not an option. Jay Powell, as much money as he's pumped into markets since 2020, does not believe in MMT. Around the world, the U.S. Federal Reserve is one of the smallest monetizers of federal-related debt in the world for a Western country. The nations that have monetized the most debt are in Europe. And as long as you have a Federal Reserve chair like Jay Powell or his successor, which will be appointed by Biden in 2022, you're not going to have MMT. The Federal Reserve is not going to monetize the entire debt, buying it up. It's not going to happen. And so as a result, the Congress and the Senate will be reforming. The two major programs in this country that are considered third rail, you don't touch them at all costs. If you do, political suicide. And that's what happens when you touch these issues too early. George W. Bush in 2003 presented a Social Security reform program that was broadly unpopular. And as a result, despite winning in 2024, it likely cost him the House and the Senate in 2006, allowing Democrats to take both houses from him and then also help elect Barack Obama. Barack Obama would have likely won anyway, but his margins were even higher because Bush touched the sacred cows of Medicare and Social Security far too early. And so like 1982, which saw Ronald Reagan and a Democratic House and Senate touch the third rail issue, you're likely going to see it again. And so the argument you're going to start hearing in the coming years is that we can either print a ton of money and inflation will destroy your savings, your children's savings, and your Social Security benefits, even if you get them in full, or we can reform it and you might get some of it. Some or none. That's what you're going to start hearing within the next couple of years. And as a result, what will likely happen is for Social Security, you should expect taxes to increase. Payroll taxes will increase. And that's broadly going to be very unpopular. Payroll taxes are already 3.5% for people and 3.5% for companies. So in total, it's like a 7% tax on you. I wouldn't be surprised if that went to 10% or 12% within the next couple of years. Two, the age of eligibility is likely to increase 5 to 10 years from 66 to 74 in order to receive full benefits. People can technically retire at 62 right now to receive Social Security. But if you do that, you essentially walk away without a third of your retirement, the funds you put in. But if you wait till 66, you receive 100%. And so as a result, Congress is likely to increase the age in which you receive full benefits from 66 to 74. And even there's the possibility they split it by gender. Since the dawn of the opioid crisis and the suicide epidemic in the United States, the gap between how long women live compared to men has grown. Women now live 81.1 years while men live 76.1. So it's a 5-year difference. And so what you might see is the age of eligibility for Social Security to be split along gendered lines. Men will likely have a retirement eligibility for Social Security at 72. So theoretically, they could have Social Security benefits for 4 years compared to the status quo, which is you have it for 10 years. I did my math wrong there, I think. No, I didn't. 10 years. For women, this is going to be a very broadly unpopular move. But for women, the age of eligibility will likely be 75 until you get your benefits for 4 or 5 years, just like the men, 4 or 5 years. For Medicare, because the age of eligibility is the same, I believe it's 64, straddling between 66 and 62, you'll likely see the age of eligibility increase to 72 or 74, and you'll likely see some trimming in your benefits as well, opening up opportunities for the private sector to provide supplemental plans, which is ironically the only thing Bush was able to pass, adding Medicare B and C, I believe, which will take more pressure off federal pockets and putting it more in the private sector in your pockets. And so that will happen for us young people. It just means it just means like we have to work longer, and we were sort of expecting that anyway. And the fact that we stand a chance of seeing some of our benefits that we've already paid into the system. I've probably paid in $2,000 to $3,000 already from my work as a valet driver and working for the Ronald Reagan International Airport during university. At least I might see a third or at least 2/3 of that money. It's good news for us, but it's not good news for baby boomers, as some of them will likely become ineligible for a couple more years and be forced to work longer or do what I'll talk about in a bit. And so I think it's likely that Biden may attempt to touch this issue in 2023 or 2024. But because with the wide expectation that he's going to be a one-term president and then allow Democrats to put up a younger candidate in 2024, he will likely leave the topic to his successor, as there will be no political will to touch it until after the election, when you're closer to the cliff. And Congress has a history of waiting till you're on the cliff before you reform anything. Financial markets during this time will also likely be squeezed for most of this decade, starting as soon as 2022 or 2023, where you will see your first major correction in the stock market, the Dow Jones, the S&P, the NASDAQ, where you'll probably lose 2/3 of value on the entire exchange. And the end of the sort of philosophy that has sort of propelled American society for the past 60, 70 years, which is markets always go up, and on some of the more unpleasant sides of the internet, buy the dip, stupid. And so for most of this decade, stock performance will be broadly negative or broadly flat. And so that, as I've mentioned before, comes from the baby boomers pulling money out of the system. And so we will likely see the pension crisis for a lot of the states who have major state benefit programs. 3/5 of them who are underfunded, and 2/5 of them which are severely underfunded, California and Illinois being like the two biggest bombs in the system, will probably be the last time the American government passes a very, very large stimulus or bailout package, as the Federal Reserve will likely announce they will be willing to monetize that debt, so at least taxpayers or people who've contributed to state pension funds can be made whole. But as a result, most state pension fund holders will likely only receive 60 to 75% of their benefits, which will have detrimental effect on 401ks in the private sector, as well as mass liquidations cause a devaluing of retirement savings as well. And that's where we sort of get into our third topic, which is demographics, which I've sort of captioned as parents as your roommate. Your parents, if you're between 16 and 30, so Gen Z and young millennial, are retiring or have already retired. My dad just retired this past year, and my mom's been retired for almost a year and a half. As you continue through college or reflect on your first job, you may have considered that you might need to move into your parents to save money, or if you're successful, to not even have to move in with your parents at all. But you probably never considered that your parents might need to move in with you. My advice? You should start planning now. 60% of baby boomers are likely to have enough money saved up or access to private 401ks to retire comfortably or very thriftily on the cheap. It's not a proud existence, but it's a living. However, 40% of them are likely to not have enough money, as they'll lose money from state pension funds, which are liquidated quickly, or lose out because of the Social Security and Medicare reforms. This cohort will have enough money to live, obviously, but will likely choose to live with you to save that money. As a result, the concept of the Italian multi-generational home is about to become a large cohort of the American population, as intergenerational wealth and poverty coalesce to form a semi-new middle class, where young professionals or married couples living with their parents, where their parents will use their savings to provide money for vacations, food, gas, and other necessities, presents for Christmas. It is your young children's dream of always being near your grandparents. This trend will likely start in 2024, but become the dominant trend in 2026. Now, as I mentioned, 60% of them will have the money to live on their own pretty comfortably, or at least on the cheap. 40% of you will likely need to move in with your kids to split the cost of living. But even then, obviously those are pretty some hard and fast numbers, we're likely to see more than 40% of that group, of that 100%. This is where you get percentages. Percentages are really messy, nasty numbers once you start doubling them or messing with the quantities. But of that 40% that can't live independently or on their own, they'll live with you, the 60%, probably another 10% will just choose to do it anyway, as the relations between families is different, obviously. But if they're good relations, they might choose to move in together anyway. for those of you who have strained relations with your parents or you don't talk often, there's a good chance you'll likely start sharing a house or a very large apartment with them in the future. You should probably work on your relationship with your parents. If relations are very good with your parents, then you'll just have a pleasant coming home party, where if you have young children, they will be the center of attention, giving you a much needed break from being a parent. Something that I'm about to experience as my young daughter, my first daughter, is expected to arrive first week of January. I will likely be and this is actually ironically a conversation I've already had with my parents, that sometime down the line we might combine households to help with a family. And I encourage people who have good relations with their parents to explore this conversation as well. And those of you who have strained relationships to start repairing them. Not only is it good, obviously, for you to know that your family's on your side and that your relations are good and that you can count on them in the pinch, but some of you will be likely living with your parents as a means to not only help support you, but also to support them. And as a result, as the title of this sort of section is a very short section, as we sort of touched on the issue of demographics in the first two, but your parents are likely to become your roommates, or at least the caretakers, something that society was very used to in the early to mid 20th century, with multi-generational households where Mima and Papa live in the other segment of the house. That's likely to return again. And so the ability for households to get along and also share wealth is going to become incredibly important. And some of you who have said that I'm always going to live independently of your parents should probably look at the mirror and reflect and say, I should probably have a bit more flexibility in my life planning. And so to sort of conclude on that lighter note I hinted at the very beginning, the 2030s will be a fantastic decade for you. And the reason for that is in 2022, we'll see baby boomers taking money from the system. And then the 2030s is when we'll start seeing the money return to the system, either through deep integration between families under multi-generational housing. Millennial and Gen Z people will have broader access to their parents' money, increasing the standard of living of both families as you, the young worker, move up the corporate or bureaucratic ladder, increasing your income along the way. For some of you who don't choose to live with your parents or your parents have the ability to live independently, the first of the baby boomers will likely start passing in 2026, with that rate accelerating through the early 2030s, leaving many with an inheritance that will exceed their basic needs, allowing for consumption spending to start picking up again to pre-2020 levels, and an easing of credit requirements and a decline of interest rates for mortgages and student loans and other loans as money starts returning to the system, greasing the gears of the economy. While Joe Biden's presidential run is sort of the embodiment of the return to normalcy, we will only start to experience that return to normalcy in 2030. In fact, 2030 for the United States will be the decade of the good morning of America was for Ronald Reagan and for baby boomers and Gen Xers in the 1984 era. 2030 will be that era for us, the good morning in America, the return to normalcy, growing wealth, growing prosperity. But this decade that we're about to go through, and we've already sort of gotten a hint of through 2020 and the first couple of weeks of 2021, is going to be a doozy. And so if I had to make any recommendations, and again, just to highlight this, I'm not an investment advisor. If you want to allocate money to less risky assets, I suggest you get advice from a professional, a certified investment advisor. And so with that sort of warning out of the way, what are sort of my recommendations? As I sort of talked about very heavily in the last section, if you have strained relations with your parents, you shouldn't. In a world that is broadly hostile to you, very competitive environments, especially if you're in the business world, Wall Street and all that such, it's a dog-eat-dog world. But the only people you could ever truly count on to have your genuine support is your family. If relations with your family are already good, fantastic. You're not going to have any problem integrating your households, sharing the wealth, and be in a multi-generational Italian family. But if you don't have good relations with your parents, or you just don't talk to them a lot, if those barriers can be overcome, I encourage you to overcome them. As those of you who are in that young cohort, 16 to 30, and I'll probably even increase that to 35, there is a good chance you will be living with your parents or your parents will be living with you. And if some, obviously, if your parents were abusive and they were assholes, okay, I can understand that. But if you look at yourself and say, some of these issues are really kind of stupid, then I encourage you to overcome them. Talk with them, rebuild the bridge. Because if you don't, when you're living with them, they're going to come up anyway. And so it's better to sort of get them out of the way. Now, become a united front and learn to be a family again. When it comes to politics, this is a hard recommendation to make, as politics is usually characterized by the feeling of the heart. I would encourage you not to do that. Politics is as Machiavellian as it always has been. It's all about mind games. It's all about strategy. It's all about presentation, marketing. And as a result, you need to know when someone is tricking you and when someone's not, or whether a certain position your party is taking is in line with what you need as a family, as a singular worker, or just an individual. Politics, because of the realignment, is going to get very messy. So I encourage you to familiarize yourself with taxes, financial regulations that affect individuals, so capital gains taxes again, so taxes in general, what laws are around, how much tax, again, it's just taxes, your FICA, your MICA, your payroll taxes, all the fun stuff that the government takes from you every year. Some of those things are going to be going up. So budgeting is going to become more important, and that sort of takes us into the economic recommendations. Broadly, risk off. You can have market swings up and down. You can bet on Bitcoin. You can have fantastic bets on real estate between now and 2022. But once money starts getting pulled out of the system, not only is the music going to stop at the proverbial party, but the rug is going to be pulled out from underneath all of us. So you should be saving. You should be putting money into safe places. You should not be taking risky bets on assets that are highly illiquid or very volatile. I think Bitcoin is going to be one of those that's going to collapse in 2022, as all the money that's currently chasing yield, because it's sort of the last stop shop to get as much money as you can, starts broadly taking money out of the system and de-risking, moving into bonds, moving into gold, or even some of these other things that are considered safe havens, or even municipal bonds. And as a result, you should be keeping an eye on the market, because obviously the market's going to go open up and down during this period. But you should be looking at a broadly negative market environment from 2022 to at least 2028. And so just keep an eye out, learn to budget, mend relations with your family, keep good relations with your family if you already have them, and just start planning for the future. For some of you college students or college-age students, because I know some of my listeners are at least coming out of college or are on their first job, you need to learn to realize that the world isn't all about you. I'm welcoming my first child into the world, and that, even though she's not technically born yet, I can feel the responsibility already. Being married young, I feel that responsibility very young early. While a lot of you will choose probably to marry later and have kids later, the responsibility to think about other people and then think about sort of the long term and not going out every week, not partying with your friends, those are going to become very important. And so you should start budgeting. You should start researching as much as you can about tax policy and how that could affect you in the future. Finance policy, how is that going to affect your savings or your 401k? Assuming if you work for a company and that has a 401k, and even most state governments have 401ks now because the defined pension plan has become so unpopular. Just be careful. Keep an eye out. Take in as much information as you can. Desensitize, or at least put aside emotional issues and start looking at the things that are truly important in your life. Your family, your savings, and your future. And on that note, next week, I'm probably going to talk about Europe in the 2020s and what people should expect along the three dimensions I've covered in this episode. And so, again, not to cheat again in the future, but I probably will, as I love talking to Jeremiah, great friend of mine. Super smart dude, too. But expect the episode to next week to be up at the same time. I'm getting this sort of early schedule Monday, 8:30. It will hopefully be up and in your inbox or on your favorite location for Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Have a great rest of your week, everyone. Try to stay away from the politics. Politics is toxic if you think with your heart. It's not good for you. I did it for most of my high school. Hated it. I regret it to this day. De-risk yourself, take away from politics, spend time with family. And most importantly, have a great rest of your week and even better weekend. Cheers and happy Wednesday.